This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, it's Live and Learn. I'm Chua Ntik. My guest today, Dr. Ron Chung, has a very daunting academic resume. In addition to a Bachelor of Science in Biology and Chemistry, he has a law degree from the University of London, a Master's in Medieval Philosophy and Islamics from Yale University, as well as a couple of postgraduate degrees from Princeton Theological Seminary, which is where he also earned his PhD. I got to know about Dr. Chung because he was recently in KL to present his research on religions along the Silk Road, which is also the topic of our conversation today. Ron, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to join you.
Can we begin with you giving us a brief introduction about your long intellectual development and journey?
Okay, I was born in Kuala Lumpur in 1960 and third generation Christian. So I've always thought about being who I am, and part of my family is being Christian. Went on to study the sciences and then went to England to study law. And one of the things that intrigued me was a discovery that there are so many other religions around the world, and I know nothing about them. So that led me at some point in time to ask myself some questions about how can I be sure that what I believe is in fact true? Because strangely enough, in the world of religion, falsifiability and verification are not major issues, but they are very major issues in natural sciences. So that led me to do field work, boots on the ground research, and that's what I do now. I go around to different parts of the world to examine the history of doctrines, history of teaching, history of civilization. And my most recent trip was to Xinjiang, to Western China, because that's where five major world religions found confluence, and they sort of thrived, survived, and died. And I was interested in that. So that's what led me to all of this.
Yes, religion is very much a team sports, isn't it? If you're in one team, then you're not likely to go out into the other team to understand where they are coming from. And when you're doing this, when you're trying to marry the disciplines of science with religion, do you not see a lot of conflict? Is it not difficult to put them together?
Well, here's the thing about religion. It's almost always an inheritance. Few of us actually grew up to say, I have surveyed the 120 religions in the world, and I've chosen this one because of this reason. So that intrigued me, the fact that we inherit our religions rather than make choices. It's after the fact that we spend most of our adult life trying to defend why we embrace a certain religion. So in fact, it's not really true. We grew into it, and then we spend our whole life trying to defend it to ourselves and to others. The natural sciences is what is called bottom-up. You experience something and you try to model a theory to see whether it fits a general idea. A religion on the whole tends to be top-down, meaning you inherit something. There's normally an idea of divine revelation for most religions, and then from there on, you interpret the world from this lens. Since I started in the world of the natural sciences, and I went on to do, applied humanities, that's what law is. My training in law helped me to suspend final judgment, to play a counterfactual, to put myself in the shoes of the other side. Because what happens in what is called moot court, the professor will say, I won't tell you which side you're on, but here are the facts of the case. Prepare yourself to be to represent either one of the sides. And that's very daunting, which means you must be prepared to probe the weaknesses of your own arguments, which is something even the natural sciences don't really do very much. So I found that very useful. So my training in the sciences helped me to identify evidence. My training in the legal system helped me to suspend final judgment. And my training in theology helped me to be open to metaphysical reality. So these three together helped me to see that no single field is dominant, but together they can enhance each other.
So going back in time, religions across the Silk Road, what did you want to learn with this project?
Well, I'm going to say something which may be strange to a lot of people. If you want to know a lot about Christianity, the last place and the worst place to go is basically to the Mediterranean world or to Europe, because Christianity is dominant there, has been for a long, long time, meaning it has always enjoyed the patronage of power and economics. So you can't really know what really happened in the beginning. If you want to know about Hinduism, India is the worst place to go to. Same thing. You have the power and patronage that dominated India. Buddhism almost died out in India and went on to other parts of Asia, East Asia and China. And similarly, if you want to know about Islam, the Arabian states may not be the best place to learn about it, but the Silk Road is a neutral territory for about up to 7,000 miles long from China to Venice. That is no man's land in a sense. What's interesting about trade is that trade has always brought in religions, because in early traders, when they meet each other, the first thing they ask, this was before nation states in 1648, the first thing they ask is, who are you and which god do you worship? Identifying your god helps people figure out who you are. Are you safe to be with? What are your assumptions in life? And how can I deal with you? Can I trust you? Now, because of this, trade along the Silk Road has always waxed and waned with the powers that propped up various religions. So you have, for example, Zoroastrianism, very, very early on from Iran, what we call modern Iran today. You've got Manichaeism, a form of a hodgepodge religion that Christians would consider heretical. Others may say that it's a religion that became a victim of other religions. And then you've got Buddhism, came from India into Afghanistan and Pakistan, what is called a Gandharan civilization, and went eastward into China. And then you've got Islam, the desert cloud that came from Saudi Arabia. So these five religions sort of fought it out, and each period in history, in different locations, one of them will be predominant. And when the political and economic cycles change, the dominance also changed. So I was interested in why they changed. I wanted to interview people. So in that case, China, in the Uyghurs, are largely today Muslims. And they are not of the same Islamic ideas as we understand from the Shiite and Sunni confluence. They have their own version. I wanted to know, why was it that before the 8th and 9th century, they were Buddhists? And then before that, long before that, they were Manichaeans. So what made the entire culture change religion? So that was my primary interest in it. I also wanted to find out about the emergence of Christianity in Tang Dynasty China in the 7th century, when Christianity, the first documented Christianity, arrived in China in the city of Chang'an, which is today's modern Xi'an, in 635 AD. That's the same year that Christianity officially went to England, to the city of York, which is quite amazing when you think about it. But surprisingly, that Christianity was not from Rome. It was from Baghdad, of all places, a region that today we think of as being Islamic. But that region used to be one of the most dominant and preeminent Christian places in the world in its day, in the 7th century.
Just to come back a little bit, what was the language, if God was the primary identification tool, what was the language that these traders were speaking to each other in?
Well, it depends. I'm using Marco Polo as one of my guides. And of course, in his case, his claim was that he learned Chinese, he learned Mongolian, he learned Turkic and Uyghur. These are four major languages along the Chinese part of the Silk Road. But along the way, they would have dominant languages. One of them is a language called Sogdiana, a Sogdian language, which is today's modern Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and parts of Uzbekistan, one of the five stans that Stalin carved out of what is called Central Asia. And we don't know exactly which particular language, but Silk Road experts will tell you they've identified 17 different languages that's been used across the Silk Road. Now, bear in mind, almost nobody traveled the entire length of the 7,000 miles. So they would go perhaps 50 miles, 60 miles along the way, and as you transition from east to west and also from west to east, you'll find the languages merge into each other a bit. You'll find the hybrids of languages so that they can just about get by. And you find that in Malaysia, for example. If you grew up as a Penang Hokkien speaking person like I did, I was born in Kuala Lumpur, but we spoke Penang Hokkien. Penang Hokkien adopts a lot of Malay words in it, partly because of the Baba Nyonya influence, where you have the Chinese sailors coming from Ming Dynasty China and settling in Malacca, in Penang, in parts of Singapore, and then marrying the local Malay girls. So from that confluence, you have this confluence of languages itself. Malay, as well as some parts of Chinese dialects in Malaysia, have also adopted Sanskrit terms. So we use Indian words into part of a vocabulary. Now, this sort of things happen for thousands of years throughout the world, so that very few languages are pristine. Very few languages are completely detached from every other language in the world. So when I was in Turkey, for example, doing a lot of archaeological work, what surprised me was that the word bazaar is the same word that we have as pasar in Malay.
Wow.
Basically, it's a market. The word sabun is used in Turkish, but they actually borrowed from the French word savon, which means soap. So sabun, savon, the same word, soap. You have gaja, bottle, and all these other words. So learning ancient languages helped me identify where they move and how the transition of languages, trade, and economics come together.
Beyond the people and the sites, were there any sources or documents that you were able to lay your hands on or consult or read?
Well, here's scholars to know about 1906 on some of the majors. They're not scholars, they're adventurers in those days. They came from Paris, they came from London, later on from Harvard University, essentially 12 non-Chinese countries went to do Western China. And collectively, they brought out, the Chinese would say they stole it, they would say they bought it. They brought out hundreds of thousands of documents, mostly of Buddhist literature. And today they are in the great museums of the world. You'll find some in the Metropolitan Museum here in New York. You'll find a whole stash, I think it's 25,000 documents in the British Library brought in by Sir Orrell Stein, who was a Hungarian, but became a British citizen later on for his efforts. You'll find Paris has quite a bit in the Louvre Museum in Paris, St. Petersburg. They have that in National Museums as well. And of course, the famous Pergamon Museum in Berlin. China itself is now working to make these documents available to the world. And there's a major project done by the British Library called the International Dunhuang Project. And there, they're asking all these major museums to allow them to digitize it in London and then make it available in a website for the world to see. A lot of it has not been translated. A lot of it remains in private hands as well. So it's not very easy to know exactly what the story was. But today, if you go to the caves in Dunhuang, in the Kizil Caves in Western China, you'll still find a lot of artwork and paintings. And paintings are very important in this world of Silk Road Christianity because most people couldn't read and write. So writing was really for the elite. But a lot of people can look at images and from the paintings, they can tell the story. And that's what the Buddha's Jataka tales were all about. You can look at the color scheme. If it's blue and green, you'll know which period it's painted on. If it's red and orange, you'll know hundreds of years later in the Tang Dynasty, they use this sort of pigment. So scholars look at the different color schemes, the different representation of the Buddha's face, because the earliest Buddha's faces had a Greek look. It didn't look Chinese or Indian at all. And then later on, the Buddha took on a more oriental look depending on when they settled in. And the reason was the earliest sculptors and earliest painters of the Buddha did it somewhere in Afghanistan and Pakistan in a civilization called a Gandharan civilization. And many of them were descendants of Alexander the Great's army. So they were half Greek and half Indian, or half Greek and half what we would call Afghani. And because of that, their representation of the Buddha looked very Western. So that's quite interesting for me to see the transition of the Buddha's face.
I'm speaking today to Dr. Ron Chung about his research, Religions Along the Silk Road. We'll talk more after this short break. You're listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, it's Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antic. If you've just joined us, my guest Ron Chung is an interdisciplinary scholar. What is the nature of your work?
Well, my work started as simply a scholar of the Bible and a scholar of Christianity, and it led me to ask questions about other religions of the world. And so my framework is the term called geohistory. I sort of coined the term some years ago to describe to my students that where you were born and when you were born makes a big difference in who you are and what you think about God. Meaning, if you were born in a country that is predominantly Hindu or predominantly Islamic or predominantly Christian, it's very unlikely that you will pay attention to the other options in terms of religion that's available. If you were born in a time period where you have access to technologies that would not exist otherwise, your understanding of God would change dramatically as well. So I caution my students to be mindful of this, to be generous to those who do not agree with them, and to be aware that both our human understanding of God and a human understanding of who we are evolves over time. So let me give you one quick example. Last week when I was teaching a course, I ask my students a question. If Jesus was born in the 21st century, and we have something like 7 to 8 billion cell phone cameras around, our image of Jesus would be very different from the one we have that's drawn from medieval paintings of Europe, where Jesus is largely Caucasian man with an aquiline nose and largely blonde hair and blue eyes, right? If Paul had access, for example, Paul, the biblical writer, had access to a microscope invented in 1609, would he then use the phrase, there are things that are seen and unseen? Because now he knows there are things that we cannot see that remain unseen until we see through a lens. So what I do is I study the history of all these technologies and discoveries, where it came from. So I look at scientific discoveries, technological innovations, and medical advances. In each case, over time, as new understandings come about, we change our view of the world. So let me give you, for example, three examples of scientific discoveries that became technological advances and how their medical advances nearby also help us be more confident in the way we do things. For example, I do a lot of archaeological work. If it wasn't for the technology of the jet engine, it would not be possible to go safely to a lot of places I go to. If it wasn't for medical advances in pharmacology and nutrition to help me avoid illnesses by eating the right things and avoiding some food, I would not survive many of my trips. If it wasn't for the fact that in the 1960s, radiochronometry invented the idea of machines that could, for the first time, quite accurately measure anything you find from the ground using carbon-14, you can use uranium, thorium-uranium, which for millions of years. So today, for the first time, we can date anything. Now think about this. Until the 1960s, every artifact in every museum in the world was guessing the age of the artifacts they have. There's no way to find out. Suddenly, you have an opportunity to test it for the first time. You can imagine the dramatic changes in every museum of the world. When the world was confirmed to be not flat, 1522, when Magellan's last ship made it to Cadiz in Spain, they knew the world wasn't flat, not because they thought it wasn't, now they know it wasn't, because they went westward and they came back from the east. What impact does this have? Well, it questions a lot of things we take for granted. Now, under this rubric, is the Bible to be read as a scientific historical text, or is it a moral text, or is it a theological text? And of course, there are some implications for this. If one part of the Bible fails the test of geography and history, does every part of the Bible fail the test of geography and history? And of course it doesn't, because the Bible is not a single book. It's a book of multiple genres. And the earlier books tend to be written much earlier, and they were metaphorical, they were analogical, they were trying to tell a certain spiritual truth without concern about whether it's verifiably historical or scientific, because these were not the questions people asked in those days. Development, for example, of germ theory in 1905, for the first time, helped people to understand you get ill because of small things called germs and not because of a punishment from an evil person called Satan. And by the same token, most of us can get healed or cured using other small things, pills and medicines that we have developed to help us. Now, that is not to take away from the importance and the powers of prayer and ritual, but it's to say that when we can, we should take the responsibility to find out if something is to be true or was it invented over time. Because remember, all religions are not really revelations of God. They are human responses to revelation. So I'm aware that none of us can honestly claim that God spoke to us last night and no one else. But what we can claim is that we can draw from the wisdom of the ages, of people who have encountered spiritual issues that we cannot imagine or we cannot verify, but we can learn from them.
Coming back to the Silk Road, can you tell us the story of Elopen?
Oh, Elopen, as far as we know, now bear in mind, we don't know his real name. This is a name given by the Chinese Tang Dynasty. And he arrived from the Syriac-speaking world, and we suspect is near Baghdad. We don't know for sure exactly, because what we have is a stone erected in 781, made of granite. And today it's right in the Stela of Forest in Xi'an itself, just outside the city gates. And this stone was discovered in 1623. There were Jesuits and other Christians from the Vatican in the 17th century in China, and they were digging to build a foundation. They found this huge stone, and this stone was erected in 781, but it was hidden to protect it from others who were invading the land. We don't know who the others were. On this stone, 1900 Chinese words and about 50 words of a different language. That language was, in fact, Syriac. And everyone was surprised by this. How did that Islamic world's language get onto the stone to describe Christianity? On the stone, it was the second emperor of the Tang Dynasty who welcomed this chap, and they named him Elopen. We do not know his real name. But 150 years later, they erected this granite stone to celebrate the arrival of Christianity. And the Christianity was called the religion of light in the translation. And it talked about Moyen, Mary. It talked about Ishu, Jesus. It talked about the cool wind, the Holy Spirit. So this was exciting, but it was, of course, traumatic for the Roman Catholics to discover that they were not the first to bring Christianity there, that Christianity much older came on. And they were struggling to find out, is this one of us? And of course, it wasn't one of them. And this is because sometime in the 5th century, the church split into two very major divisions. And one of them was not heard of much until very, very recently. And today we call them the Nestorian Church, named after a bishop called Nestorius. The history is a bit convoluted, but the long and short of it all was a quarrel in the church over how we should describe Mary. Was Mary the mother of God, or was the Mary the mother of Jesus? So the two groups split over this. Elopen, when he arrived in China, brought with him what they then knew as the scriptures, the sacred scriptures. The Tang Dynasty, of course, famous for its culture and the height of civilization, wanted to absorb all these religious ideas because they knew religion was wisdom and people are fundamentally religious. And by the way, in all my research, I've never come across yet a single human community which is not religious. Religion is part of culture. Religion is a cultural artifact. And culture is driven by religious aspirations. So that's an interesting thing to think about. In fact, what we call atheists was some sort of reaction to the dominance of the church and corruptions and all that. It came about sometime in the 19th century, largely in the Germanic countries. But even among people who call themselves atheists, they actually have metaphysical aspirations. And you can tell in things like superstition, for example. You can tell in things like they would not have a building with a 14th floor. They won't walk under any ladder because they fear that could be a, you know, soy bantang. You'll find that there are all kinds of things, including celebrating birthdays. Birthday celebration is itself a ritual that has nothing to do with science at all. It was part of a pagan celebration to celebrate the fact that the devil has not taken the life of a child at the age of one. So there are all of these celebrations, funerals, occasions when you can see even the most hardcore atheists feel a strong sense of emotion as they say goodbye to their loved ones. So there are all kinds of reasons to demonstrate that, in fact, none of us are atheists. It's just that some of us are religious. We haven't found the name of our religion yet.
So birthdays and funerals have origins in paganism.
Not just paganism, highly, highly ritualized superstition. Now, when I say superstition, I don't demean it. I'm just saying it's a very thin line between superstition and ritual. It's a very thin line between magic and miracle. Normally, if we don't like another person, we'll call theirs magic to make fun of them, and ours is a miracle, right? If we don't like the beliefs of others, we'll say, oh, this is all absolute nonsense, but ours is especially spiritual. So what I try to do in my research is to identify that, in fact, most of us are very biased and prejudiced in the way we name and claim the things that we believe in. And somehow we demean or caricaturize others that we don't agree with without even knowing what they are. In fact, this is why after studying Christianity, I went on to study Islam and then later Buddhism and Hinduism. And by 2013, I'd gone to Iran to spend some time studying Zoroastrianism. And a year later, I was in West Africa to study the voodoo cultures and subsequently to Australia to study the totemic shamanism of the Aboriginals in Australia.
Just to linger a little bit longer on the story of Elopen, when you know something like this, how do you feel looking at this situation in Syria today?
Very sad, because In fact, there's no need for religious strife. Religion can be an incredible power for good and for very positive things. In fact, my study of Islam, my study of Buddhism and of the other religions has given me a great and immense respect for most of its leaders who began it. Now, what happened, I think, is as religious ideas become institutionalized, as they become politicized, monetized, and economics play a very major role, they tend to take on a life of its own. And sooner or later, you now have to feed the dragon that you have fed and created. So, for example, I was interested in the movement of the religions along the Silk Road. My guide was a professor at Columbia University. His name is Richard Foles. He wrote a very slim book about this. And another person who was with me in Xinjiang is Professor Johann Elverskog, one of the leading thinkers in this area. And interestingly, he's Swedish, a Swedish-American, but he speaks Mandarin, Mongolian, Uyghur, and Tibetan. These are the four major languages of the Silk Road. So interestingly enough, when we were traveling along the Chinese Silk Road, you discover that so many of the personal aspirations of religion were tied to economics, were tied to trade, tied to feeding the families, which is a right thing to do. And very few of them are deeply theological, which is something the West is more interested in. So in the Western world, we have a lot of doctrines that we built up over the years. And in my mind, as a Christian, sometimes we create obstacles for people to jump over and create hoops, which are sort of unnecessary. And it obscures one of the important teachings of Jesus, compassion and love. You'll find compassion a very strong and central feature in the Buddhist thinking as well. And of course, Muhammad himself, in his life, what was written about him has always mentioned the fact that he was trustworthy, he was generous, he was gentle, even though we have this clouded image of Muhammad as the warrior and the fighter. So part of my work was to find the people behind the myth, the people behind the realities. We'll never know everything, by the way. And of course, being from a raiding community of the Bedouin, when they went to what we call war, it's not considered a bad thing. That's how people worked in nomadic cultures. So what I do now is I look at, if you look at any world religion or culture, you normally ask yourself, is it an agricultural culture or is it a nomadic culture? These two cultures have two different incentives. Incentives will always drive decision-making processes. If you're a nomadic culture and you have animals that need grazing, by definition, you will invade. By definition, you will go to another person's land and take the grass for your animals and you move on. And it's not seen as a bad thing. It's seen as that's what you do. And you survive by being the stronger. Now, if you're an agricultural community and you're a settled land, you now have to plant seeds and you sit around and wait at least 3 months for the seasons to turn before you can get a seed to become crops, right? You sacrifice because while the seed is growing, you can't eat anything. So you have to wait for the seed to grow. In the meantime, you eat of things that you saved from the previous time. So your whole world is highly defensive. You build walls in your cities and you try to stop attacks from nomadic people. So these are the two major sort of religious cultures that you find in humanity. And if you know this well, and you ask, where do you come from and what God you worship, you can tell the incentives that drives these people. So that's what I was doing in the Silk Road. In the Silk Road, they are mostly nomadic peoples. So raiding, stealing from each other or taking from each other is how they survive. It's not morally good or bad. They accept it as this is part of existence. But if you're from an agricultural culture, for example, in Europe, where you grow crops and there's a lot of rain and you have a lot of good soil, you'll see the raiding culture as a negative force, as a threat to your existence. This is the framework and the rubric by which I work on to understand civilization and humanity.
You mentioned along the Silk Road that religion is shaped in large part by politics and economics. And today, our cultural values and fear of the other are shaped a lot by religious caricatures. Are there any lessons from the Silk Road that would be instructive for today's climate, you reckon?
Well, I think so. I spoke to my guide. His name is Ali. He's a Uyghur. And I asked him, I said, are you comfortable me being a Christian and you're guiding me through a largely Islamic land? And he said, yes, because I'm a professional guide. I make a living through it. I detach my personal belief from what you believe. Now, we were sitting down to eat, and being a Muslim, he could not eat in a Chinese restaurant. He would eat in a Muslim restaurant. So I was sensitive to that, and I said, is it okay for you to be near me while I eat, or should I move somewhere else? And he said, oh, no, not at all. I'm a Muslim, but I don't mind what you eat. It's just that I don't do it as a matter of respect for my religion, and that was that. So I asked him a question, have you always been Muslim? He says, as far as I know, we have always been a Muslim people. Now, he's talking about the Uyghurs. Knowing what I know, I said, wasn't it the case that before the 8th and 9th centuries, there were no Muslims in the area because Islam hadn't yet arrived? He was caught off guard a bit. And he said, well, now that you mention it, yes, because we do learn in school that before the Islamic age, there was the Buddhist age. We were all Buddhists. I said, how interesting. And then before the Buddhist age, well, we are Manichaeans. So I said to him, does it show that, in fact, you are Muslim because you are born today in this period, in this era, that your forefathers were born in different time and space and they were not Muslims, they were Buddhists, and before that, the Manichaeans? He said, yes. And then he said something that really helped me think through all of this. When he meets outsiders, meaning non-Muslims going to Xinjiang, he began to ask a lot of questions. Would his life be very different if he was born outside of Xinjiang and therefore not necessarily a Muslim? Would he be just as happy? Would he be just as good a person? And that, I think, is why the Muslim culture in China, Western China, tends to be more tolerant than other kinds of religions where there's a dominance of political powers for a long time. They don't have a lot of political power. They're still part of mainland China. And China has been officially atheistic for so long, since 1949. So they have learned to sort of be under the undercover, in the shadow, not make a fuss. They just survive and they move on. So that is something for me to think about, in the sense that even though we have different creeds and different colors and different gods, how different are we as human beings? And I'm not sure if I mentioned to you that part of my PhD work was on paleoanthropology, which is about the study of human origins. So I would study human fossils going back to 7 million years ago. And as recently as 50,000 years ago, any idea of distinct peoples just didn't exist. We were very similar because the human populations were largely in one area, mostly Africa. It really hasn't spread very much until about, well, we were guessing between 100,000 years ago, they started going to Europe. And then about 50,000 years ago, they made it all the way to Australia. But human populations to cover all the continents of the world, it was as recently as 12,000 years ago when the very last of them made it down to South America. So just think about that, right? The ideas that we are different because we live in different locations is a fallacy, because we didn't live in different locations. We migrated to different locations. We moved on and took on a new persona, took on a new culture. Our languages change, our food change. We look different as we respond to the sun and respond to the rain and the cold and the wet. So that fascinates me a lot. It tells me about the unity of humanity. So I want to bring that into religion, to think about it, to take the archaeological sciences of human origins. And then the other area that deeply interested me is the human brain itself, in cognitive neuroscience, that in the brain, our bodies are very, very similar under the skin. The unification of the human experience is much deeper than the diversification that we created because of tribalism, a sense of us against them.
That note is as good as any to end on. Thank you so much for speaking to us, Dr. Chung.
Sir, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.